Welcome to Radio at Firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters. Firehouse.com brings you the leaders of the nation's fire, rescue, and EMS services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go to Firehouse.com.
Hey, welcome to the Apparatus Architects with Mike Wilder and Tom Shand. Got a full house show today, but first we want to start off with the upcoming Firehouse Expo in Baltimore, commencing on Thursday the 16th, 17th, and 18th. A little self-promotion here. Mike and I are going to be doing two different programs, one Thursday afternoon at 1:15. So even if you're a truck guy and don't like getting out to drill in the morning, you can come in the afternoon and talk to Mike and Tom, and we're going to be doing a program on apparatus innovations. And then the engine guys, we expect you to be up front and center on Friday morning, 8:30, from 8:30 to 10 o'clock. Mike and Tom, once again, going to be doing a program on packaging apparatus, how to maximize the space on your rig. And along with that, we'll be doing a couple of apparatus architect podcasts, one on Thursday morning at 9 a.m. with representatives from three to four different major fire apparatus manufacturers. Always an interesting time. And then we'll be doing a live show to talk about things and take questions from the audience, and that will be at 10:30 in the morning on Thursday. So if you're into apparatus, you have some apparatus questions or issues, we'll be available at each of those sessions to work with you folks, and look forward to seeing a lot of the brothers and sisters at that event. More importantly, our program today, we're going to talk a little bit about what's going on with the NFPA 1901 standard, with work that both Mike Wilber and Jay Gordon Routley, our good friend who's the division chief up in Montreal, have been working on religiously with respect to seatbelts and the anthropometric study. And Lieutenant Wilber, now retired, has gone worldwide. Mike just recently attended the multi-day Interschutz conference in Germany, or as compared to our conferences that we're accustomed to here in the United States, where you have any number of firematic and fire service events and expositions to attend that go basically from coast to coast, and you can take in your first one in January and still be going to ones in November. This one international conference in Germany is held once every 5 years, and according to at least the information I've already gotten from Mike, is unlike anything that we've ever seen here in the States. So we're going to talk about that. So first, Michael, glad to have you back here from not only Germany and Chicago, but most importantly, give our audience a little update over what's going on with seating, seat belts, and all things safety related.
Okay, good. Thank you, Tom, very much. Just back from Chicago, where basically what had happened over time is that we had completed the anthropometric study, and we had kept the NFPA 1901 committee in the loop as to what we were doing and when we were doing it. And unfortunately, they had a committee vote that was 27-0 in favor of not adopting the anthropometric study. And the claim was that they basically couldn't do it. And what was interesting is that I talked to a good friend, Kevin Roach, yesterday, and he said the whole situation surrounding the seating and seatbelts was much like 1991, when the NFPA was made to have a 250-pound aerial tip load at any angle, any elevation, and any extension, and the cry from the manufacturing sector was, it just can't be done. Well, here we are, some 25-odd years later almost, and 250-pound tip loads at any angle, any elevation, any extension is the U.S. norm. So I kind of think that this is going to be the same. What we were asking for is that the anthropometric study says that at a minimum, a U.S. firefighter in bunker gear needs to have a minimum of 28-inch seat width to sit down. and the NFPA standard was 22 inches. And that number came many years ago from a military standard and, of course, never accounted for a firefighter's bunker gear. And the complaints have been many but varied over time as to not being able to sit properly in the truck and not being able to grab seatbelts. And so because we were rejected by the committee, the 1901 committee, it was brought up yesterday in a NITNAM, I guess it's called. I'm unfamiliar really with the NFPA system, but I got a little more familiar yesterday. And our change was brought up in front of the technical committee for a vote in front of all the NFPA committee members. And you're allowed to speak either against or in favor. And other than one representative from the manufacturers and the committee chair, over a dozen speakers got up to the mic and spoke in favor of our resolution of 28-inch seating. And the vote was cast, and it was 186 in favor of the correct seating, and like something like 52 opposed. And so it was overwhelmingly accepted. And now it's my understanding that the 1901 committee has to go to the technical committee and basically either say that this is off the wall, or that to come up with a plan as to how over time they're going to implement 28-inch seating. The days of riding four across the back of a fire truck in the U.S. are going to be numbered, to say the least, because the math just simply doesn't work out. And that was one of the things that we were after. So I guess more to follow in the days and weeks ahead. In August, the technical committee is going to meet with the 1901 committee, and they're going to have a plan, and there'll be more to come in September after the results of that meeting are made public.
Mike, when you mentioned the number of people that voted, just for the audience's sake, that this was a general audience of all people who are NFPA members. Is that those numbers weren't indicative of people that are on the 1901 committee or happen to sit in? This was as you had mentioned earlier, an electronic ballot of those folks that were there. Is that correct?
Yeah, these are sitting NFPA members. I thought that the whole 1901 committee would be present speaking, and that wasn't the case at all. That wasn't the case at all. Evidently, from what I found out from Gordon, that there are 25,000 NFPA members that could potentially show up, I guess, and vote. The reality is that I think the fact that it's during the day, during the week, and the cost associated with this is absolutely over-the-top expensive. A full conference registration was over $1,000 for the 4 days. I think it becomes cost prohibitive for many. The group met yesterday was, given the whole size of the NFPA and their membership, was a relatively small percentage of that group, but still, according to the NFPA rules, there was a quorum there to take votes and to act on changes, or potential changes to any of the documents. And, of course, there were a number of documents that are up for review that had these NIC news, 1710, I think it's 1917, the ambulance standard was after 1901. And so it went like that throughout the day, the different standards, and people or members or people with vested interests come in and question what they're doing, and then maybe have an alternative like we did, and then it comes up to a vote, and then it's acted on. I got a sense from the short time I was there yesterday that obviously we provided a good scientific case, but a lot of times these nitinies tend to be voted down, it seems to me, anyway. So we were fortunate, right place, right time, right audience, and I think you'll see substantial changes in seating and cab configuration moving forward in fire apparatus for the U.S. So yesterday was a great day for the fire service, a great day for firefighter safety, and I would like to think that the action that the NFPA took yesterday is going to save a lot of firefighters' lives over the course of time. So congratulations to them.
That's great, great information, Mike. A somewhat lengthy and hard-fought battle. So let's switch up gears a little bit. Again, we for our listeners, we've got the Firehouse Expo coming up in Baltimore, always an excellent time, and to work with folks and to meet old friends as well as greet some new ones. And we look forward to seeing folks on the 16th and 17th on those days of at least of our programs, with the programs in the afternoon and the podcast in the morning. But, Mike, your experience, tell us a little bit about the listeners. It sounds like, as compared to some of the larger shows that we're accustomed to seeing here in the United States, where the majority of the apparatus is under a single roof or roof of one or two buildings at most, with a little modest outside display area, what was it like to go to this show, and tell us about some of the logistics to get there?
Yeah, I went from New York, JFK, and flew to Frankfurt, where for 4 days we were guests of the Frankfurt Fire Department. Many of the fire stations, career stations, from what I was told in Europe, actually have a guest accommodation for bunkers to come in like us, and basically set up like a dorm room or a hotel room. It was actually more like a dorm room. It had kitchen facilities, and it was a pretty nice room. We were right at the main headquarters, and there were 63 overhead apparatus stores at this station. Part of it was the shops, and it was built in a square, and I had never seen anything like that before in my life. But the part of the station that fronted the street, the main street, there were 14 apparatus doors, and the apparatus were too deep in each bay. Just an amazing amount of equipment. And there were 25 firefighters and officers on duty staffing those units. An interesting change in Germany, and I don't know if it's throughout Europe, haven't been a student of that, but there was a law passed in Germany that they need to get within 10 minutes time from the time of dispatch to a place. Kind of similar rules to ISO, where we have certain response time. But in any event, for them, it's now 10 minutes, which is a big change for them. And anybody that knows a little bit about European firefighting knows that they had not too many fire stations, but they were really large. And so now they've kind of taken on more of a North America spin, and they, because of this new law that they have to be on scene within 10 minutes somewhere, that they've had to decentralize to some degree. And I know in Hanover they've built 5 new stations within the last few years to accommodate the law.
Mike, has seen pictures of the European style station uniforms and bunker gear, but I just am curious that where you were, that these people were, it was a civilian fire department, correct? I mean, these people are not military?
Yeah, no, they were all civilian. We were, we had a chief officer by the name of Marcus that showed us around, and I have never been impressed like that with anybody in a long time. He was in his late 30s, early 40s at the most. Very well educated, really understood the fire service there, and maybe one of the smarter people I've ever met in this business. Just really impressive. They have just a whole different approach to fire apparatus and firefighting that heretofore I had never even been exposed to. So For somebody that retired after 32 years in the FDNY, spent 40 years in the volunteers, had always been around the fire service and fire trucks, and at 58 years old, I learned an awful, awful lot, and I think I became a better person and perhaps a better firefighter by having that experience. But almost to a point, they outsmart fires there. Unlike the U.S., where if you die in the line of duty, it's almost like a badge of honor. There, it's unacceptable. They don't have the fanfare of line of duty deaths like we do here. If you get killed there, you probably screwed up. And that's just their whole culture, and just vastly different.
What was their individual unit staffing, where we, you know, refer to it as an engine and a truck?
Engines are staffed with six, and trucks are two-man cab trucks. And the trucks are basically rescue riders, and that's what they're called. Their whole reason to go is if somebody's hanging out somewhere, or if the brothers get jammed up, or sisters, that they come and grab them. They're not like traditional U.S. truck companies at all. It's engine heaven.
Very interesting. So after spending a couple of days there at the station, you go to this show, and it's from at least what little bit that I've seen. I mean, it looks like you basically almost need a roadmap to kind of get around and figure out what you want to see. What was it like?
Well, we left Frankfurt on a high-speed train and was going 150 miles an hour, 250 kilometers an hour, having dinner. Just an absolute amazing experience, much different than being on trains in the U.S. High-speed rail is just the way, if you're ever going to go to Europe, it's just the way to see Europe. The trains are clean, modern trains. Everybody was really nice to us, and we ended up going the two-hour trip to Hanover. Once in Hanover, we went to Innerschütz. Innerschütz started on Monday morning at 9 o'clock and ends at 6 o'clock at night. It took me, Tom, 4 full days to see everything and just see it, not investigate it, not ask questions about it, just to see it. The display area outside was probably twice the size of the dome in the convention center at the FDIC combined.
Wow.
Yeah. 200, 300 fire trucks outside, many of them ladder trucks. And then there were five buildings that, if you combine the dome and the convention center together, would be the approximate size of each of the five buildings where they had stuff. And it was, they're a very ordered society, so everything was pretty much in order. If you were into, like, rescue stuff, you went to the rescue building. If you were into EMS stuff, you went to EMS building. If you were into disaster preparedness, you went to the disaster preparedness building. If you were into PPE, it was just a whole building full of PPE and extinguishing systems and extinguishers. I never saw so many fire extinguishers in my life, just traveling from building to building. What I did is, and I'm in the process of writing some articles for Firehouse Magazine about my experience, but just to give you an idea, because I'm the truck guy, I investigated trucks. Here are the people that were there. China had a presence. The name of their aerial company is Hyaminno Technology. Holland had a presence, and their fire truck manufacturer, their aerial manufacturer, is called Hilton. And I actually got to meet Willem Hilton, who was the CEO and head of the company, and had a long talk with him. And again, a very, very sharp guy. He was he has a master's degree in metallurgy, and was very interesting and kind of filled me in on all the European ladder stuff. Finland was represented by what many of us in the U.S. would know, Bronto Skylift, and then there was another Finnish company called Vima. Italy had three aerial manufacturers represented, Stella, Multitel, and it was called B-Fire/CTE. Russia had a presence called Pazotechnika, and I'm sure I'm murdering the pronunciation of these. Dubai had a ladder built by NASCO. Japan had a ladder built by Morita. South Korea had a ladder built by Everdon. Turkey had three ladder manufacturers, Karba, Karamisselier, and Vulcan. Germany had two, Magirus, and I always called it Magirus, but you go there and you learn the proper pronunciation of some of this stuff. It's Magirus and Klaus. And, of course, the big dog at the show, here in the U.S., they're kind of a middle-of-the-road manufacturer, but worldwide, the industry leader by far is Rosenbauer out of Austria. More about those guys later. Poland had a ladder presence called Bumar, Kazaslan, and it's part of the Weiss Group. Portugal had a ladder, Louis Figueroa Company, and then France had a presence with Guimax. Their pronunciation is Guimax. Some in the U.S. pronounce it Guimax or Guimax, but it's actually Guimax is the French pronunciation of that ladder builder. What I did is I took and compared the smallest ladder truck to the biggest. And often we get asked questions, well, what is the biggest ladder truck on the face of the earth? The first one was conceived and built in 2010 by Bronto, and it is a 112-meter truck, which equates to 364 feet up in the air, U.S. It has a GVWR of 154,000 pounds, It has seven axles, four steering, and three drives. It has an overall length of 61 feet 8 inches. It has a travel height of 13 feet. It has a maximum horizontal reach of 104 feet. It takes 40 seconds, they claim, to set it up, although that unit wasn't there. There were two of them built between 2010 and now, these giant trucks. One went to Qatar, and the other went to Bahrain at a cost of $2.5 million apiece. The platform basket rating was 1,100 pounds, and yes, you could even squirt water out of it. Now, for Mr. Shan, I found the littlest ladder truck, and it was by D-Max, and the wheelbase was 118 inches. How about that? A GVWR of 24,000 pounds. An overall length of 21 feet 3 inches, a width of 7 feet 9 inches, and an overall travel height of 10 feet 8 inches. It had a jack spread of 7 feet 5 inches. Maximum height for the vehicle reach was 79 feet 6 inches, and a horizontal reach was 34 feet 3 inches. It took 80 seconds to set that up, and you could set it up on a slope, an extreme slope, of, believe it or not, plus or minus 30 degrees in the direction of the slope. The truck was built for the Bavarian Swiss Alps, and they were going to take delivery of that unit, and that was on display at the D-Max booth. So that's kind of the platform weight rating was 506 pounds. So that's kind of the big and the little on the ladder truck. I actually went up in one that was 104-meter Bronto Skylift, and there was like a needle type building there that rose above the fairgrounds, and we were actually above that, and I was taking photography looking down on that. Can't wait to show you that. But to give an engine guy like yourself equal time, there was a hydrant fire system display from Holland, and they had basically a Dixie dumpster with an automatic hose loading device that was full of 12-inch hose. And it had 6,500 feet of 12-inch supply line. Each foot of hose cost about $150, so you had hundreds of thousands of dollars just wrapped up in the hose. You could lay the hose out at 30 miles an hour. They had 3 miles an hour to pick it up. There were two firefighters in the back to help load it after this automatic hose loader got it into the back. He said in a year's time, it'll all be automated. There'll be no people on the truck. The European standard, again, is very safety conscious. He said they sell about 50 a year. There's kind of two sizes where you can get 2.5-inch to 8-inch hose, and a second bigger one is 8-inch to 12-inch supply line. They sell about 50 of these trucks a year. They've been on the market for about 25 years. And if you remember, FDNY bought some large water main type trucks, and they actually did buy them from this hydrant company from Holland and the other U.S. Department that has one of these for earthquakes to lay water main out is Berkeley, California, and had a great discussion with those folks. So you can move a lot of water in a 12-inch supply line, huh, Mr. Shan?
Absolutely, Mike. That sounds like, I'd be all over that. I'm curious that one, the largest aerial device, and I realize that these people all have their, either they're working with euros or local currency, but that seven-axle rig, any ideas to what that little gem cost backing into the apparatus space?
It was $2.5 million. That each of those countries paid for those devices. And what was interesting, when I was in the Bronto booth, the purchasing agent for Bahrain was there, and I asked them if they could go any higher. And Bronto said that probably without missing a beat, they could go to 124 meters, which is really closing in on 400 feet off the ground. The problem is going to be able to find a chassis with a GVWR rating to be able to handle that device. I got a sense from the Bahrain purchasing agent that almost to a point it was about having the largest one, and I don't know what they would do with it. I'm sure they have a purpose for it, but I think he was just thrilled that he had the largest ladder truck on Earth. But $2.5 million, that was the entry fee into that little jalopy.
I'm curious, from what you described about the way the different buildings were set up, just quickly digress and go back to your visit to the headquarters fire station. Does the fire department run and administer EMS as we do with running ambulances and medic units, or is that a third service that is separate from the fire department organization?
The fire department seemed to have ambulances. There were some private ambulances as well. It kind of seemed like it was kind of a little bit of a mishmash like it is here in the U.S. But I think overall, it's, the EMS was more, particularly in the cities like Berlin, Stuttgart, Cologne, Hanover, and Frankfurt that we visited, they all had fire department ambulances with medics on them.
Very interesting stuff, Mike. That's great. Well, want to just follow up on a long-running conversation that Michael and I have had about apparatus weights. And as we wrap up this month's show, want to reiterate a few things that for our longtime listeners and followers, please just bear with us. The only thing we can tell you is what we have talked about in the past is still more ever-present than it ever was, and it's certainly not getting any better. When you are designing a new piece of apparatus, it can be something as small and seemingly insignificant as a brush truck. It can be a tandem axle combination, non-walking, walking rescue, or any one of the Michael's aforementioned ladder trucks. You need to develop a defined equipment and tool list and have a very good idea as to what the weight of those components are. So when you go to engage the apparatus manufacturer, you can provide that to them, and rather than deferring, which is not necessarily a bad idea, but deferring to the requirements and the minimum weight capacities noted in the NFPA standard, you will have an actual hard figure as to what your tools and equipment weighs. And I guess this would be the best parallel, Michael, that I've come up with. If you've ever gone out with your wife or going out grocery shopping to buy a week or 10 days worth of provisions, and you start throwing that stuff in the basket, as many times as I've done it, I'm sometimes a little bit surprised, bordering on shock, as to when you get either to the self-checkout or you have the lovely young person check you out in the aisle to find out what the cost of admission is as they are checking into all that stuff and bagging it, and you're seeing the dollars roll up in front of you. And I don't know how many times Michael and I have looked at a fire truck, and the two of us have instinctively known this rig's probably in trouble. It's going to be overweight. We mention that to the fire department, they'll be like, oh, no, no. Engine 321, no way. It's 12 years old, never had a problem, and we should be we should be good to go. Well, you then find out magically they go out and they weigh engine 321, and lo and behold, find out maybe it's legal with respect to the total vehicle gross vehicle weight rating, but if you put X number of people in the front seat, it's overweight. In some cases, Michael and I have had ones where if nothing more than air is in the front seat, the vehicle's overweight. We're in, again, once again in the process of potentially doing some pro bono work for a department that bought a cab and chassis themselves, then contracted to have a bodybuilder put the package together, apparently no idea along the way as to what they intended to put on it for tools, weight, and equipment. Now the unit is 3 years down the road. They obviously paid for the cab and chassis because they've got a title for it, and people are complaining saying the rig doesn't handle well. Well, nobody likes to drive it. We're not really using it, and they throw their hands up and they call somebody and say, well, you know, what do we do with this situation? We can tell you to our longtime listeners, whenever it gets to the point that Michael and I write our book of entitled You Can't Make This Stuff Up, we could fill more than a chapter with stories from literally across the country, ladies and gentlemen, over what problems we have encountered with people with overweight fire apparatus, where either they suspected that there was an issue only because the rig didn't handle well, to people who had operated units for, in some cases, over 20 years and always wondered why every third year they needed tires and brakes on his vehicle, even though it only went out the door 40 or 50 times. And everybody liked the rig, but they just threw money, you know, good money after bad. And we just say the simple thing, let's go get the vehicle weighed individually, at the very least, front axle, rear axle, if you have access to individual through your state police or another agency, and can get the individual sides weighed independently to know exactly where you're at. It would just make life a lot better for everyone. And certainly, as we had opened up the show, where we're going to close the show this month, is talk about safety. We can sometimes complain ad nauseum over we don't like this vehicle or that, or look at the kind of PPE they make us wear now because I don't like this. And then you look around your house. Mike kind of intimated that the German fire service, at least, is not apparatus-centric. They don't view the apparatus as being the center of their universe and defining who they are as an organization. And we're not saying that that's good, bad, or indifferent. That's just, it's a different approach. If you walk into most fire stations in the United States, just if you even think about how you gain access to the station or where the front door is to greet the public, what's the first part of the fire station that you enter? In a lot of cases, in older stations, you go into the apparatus bays. Newer stations are designed to kind of segregate that from the public. But the whole mindset of what, how we operate it, what we do, we sometimes take things for granted that eventually gets us in trouble. So Mike's just some final parting thoughts, and we're very glad that you were able to go over there to Germany to experience that. Very, very thankful that you have put up, as they say, the good fight. We'll see what happens from here with respect to the ongoing work with the 1901 committee to make our apparatus safer. But anything you'd like to wrap up with this for this session?
Yeah, the last thing that I have, Tom, is that we were asked by NIOSH if we had another project over and above the anthropometric study and the seeding that we would like to have addressed through scientific study. And one that had always bothered me was the spacing on an American aerial ladder. European ladders are the equivalent of about 11 3/4 inches spacing between the rungs. An American aerial ladder and portable ladders are 14 inches. So to that end, NIOSH has reached out to the Michigan Engineering Center for Ergonomics and are conducting a ladder study for us. And we need some subjects. So if you are listening in the state of Michigan in the greater Ann Arbor area and you are a firefighter and you are interested, we have some information here. We need subjects that would donate 2 to 4 hours of time for this, 2 minimum, 4 maximum. Experienced firefighters are preferred. Certainly we want different body sizes. Firefighters are asked to bring shoes and gloves that they would normally use for fighting fires. The subjects are paid $25 an hour for a minimum of 2 hours and a maximum of 4. You can contact the University of Michigan Center for Ergonomics, 1205 Beale Avenue, Ann Arbor, Michigan, and the number is 734-763-2243, or the Center for FORE, or FOR Ergonomics at umich.edu. Or you can go to our website, emergencyvehiclerespondse.com. On the left-hand tab, there's a contact form. Fill that out. Let us know you're from Michigan, and we can pass your information on to Tom Armstrong, who's heading up our effort at the University of Michigan. And we are going to be able to tell through studying firefighters as part of anthropometrics with bunker gear on, what the actual run spacing should be. And so probably just like the seating, one would seem to think that we are a little off base at 14 inches, to say the least. But scientifically, we're going to be able to derive a number that's going to be a lot more precise as to what the run spacing should be to operate safely. So with your help with this, we can continue that research.
Mike, that's great stuff, and again, it's really good is that with all the other research and things going on, that it's just really, to me, heartening that we're continuing to do some things, even as people would say, you know, we've made everything about as safe as we can. There are some pundits out there to believe that, and it's just, you know, pardon the expression, but as stupid people, you know, misusing the stuff. It's great to see that this research is still continuing on, and all to the betterment of the fire service, which is just a great thing. And I'd like to compliment you if to our listeners, they have no idea at all the time and effort and sweat equity that Brother Wilbur has put into these projects
And unlike some of the other folks, not to disparage them, but, you know, we're not funded by a government agency. There's nobody funding this other than the hard work of Mike Wilbur to make these things happen. So, Michael, we acknowledge and recognize you for that good work. So, for the apparatus architects, Mike Wilbur and Tom Shan, once again, we look forward to hopefully seeing some of you folks in Baltimore, Maryland on 16, 17, and 18, and can catch any one of our two formal programs. Mike's doing a program as well as some podcast work, and we hope to see some of you folks there. So until then, everybody, when you go to take in the next run or the next event or the next training, be safe.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening. And stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these. Or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.